Nutmeg Radio
with Lauren and Nadia.
Nutmeg.
You are tuning in to Nutmeg Radio.
Welcome back to another episode of Nutmeg Radio. This week, we have a really interesting conversation with Brad Roach. Brad, do you want to kick it off by giving us a little snippet of your history or your journey and how you came to be who you are now?
Yeah, so I'm originally from England, a place called South Yorkshire. So I started as a personal trainer at about 18 years old. It's quite interesting watching my own journey. I knew my dharma or my purpose was to heal or help people. And it's just taken a while to figure out in what way that was. So I started off as a personal trainer, helping people lose weight, build muscle, whatever it might be. Did that for 2 or 3 years. And then I worked in the States for 4 or 5 years. And I actually dislocated my knee and ruptured my ACL when I was over there. So I came back to England, had surgery on it. They told me it'd take about 18 months to fully recover from it. And so I started doing something called DDP yoga or DDPY yoga, which is a rehabilitation yoga for athletes. So I started using that to rehab my own injury. And then after a few months, my whole body was stronger than it had ever been, which made me a huge lover of yoga. So interestingly, the reason I got into yoga was for physical benefit or to rehab an injury. And as I started doing more and more yoga practice, I noticed a lot of subtle changes within myself. I was probably quite a volatile, angry child, teenager. And I noticed I became a lot stiller, a lot calmer. From there came the prana, the breath work, the meditation. I started coming into myself rather than being so external. And I guess that might be where my spiritual path started. I'd say it would be around that time at 19 years old, I first started using psilocybin and using mushrooms. So that had a profound effect as well. Worked in the States for 4 or 5 years, came to New Zealand at 24, 25. I'm 30 now, so I've been here for the last 6 years. And the last several years have definitely been a big journey in terms of the spiritual path. So lots of experience with plant medicine, mushrooms, ayahuasca, San Pedro, mescaline, DMT. So I've had a lot of profound experiences with these psychotropic medicines. And over the last few years, I've gone deeper into teaching breath work, deep holotropic breath work, and breath work journeys for releasing trauma. So that's kind of brought me to where I'm at now. So I still do PT work. I teach yoga beyond the surface level, westernized yoga. So the full spectrum of yoga, karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, and raja yoga. So I cover the full spectrum of yoga. I do massage, teach breath work, and I also facilitate guided journeys, shamanic work. So that's where I am right now.
I wonder if you're a manifesting generator. Do you know your human design?
No.
Well, we should look it up after this. But what did you say that yoga was that you first started? Was it DVT?
DDP. So DDP. Yeah, he used to be a professional wrestler, believe it or not, back in the 90s. So he injured his back quite badly. I think he broke it in multiple places. They told him he'd never wrestle again. So he found yoga in terms of as a rehab tool, and then realized how amazing it was. And so he made a whole kind of a westernized yogic package based on rehabilitation for athletes. So there's a lot of athletes, rugby players, football players, mixed martial artists that use this kind of rehab yoga. But it's been a big part of my background and my career, because I've made a lot of sport-specific yoga routines, which has opened up huge doors for me. I've got to work with, you know, some of the top MMA fighters in the world, some of the top footballers, working with celebrities and things like that. So that's been a big part of my work, I suppose.
Wow.
Outside the holistic 5D work that I've fallen more deeply into.
Yeah, you started on this journey really early. If it was what you were, did you say 19?
Yeah, 18, 19. Yeah, like I said, it's like I knew my purpose, my dharma was to help or to heal. And I think the more work you do on yourself and you start to utilize all these different tools and different practices, it just makes you more versatile in what you can offer. So my work is just a reflection of the work I've done on myself, I suppose.
What got you into the plant medicine side of things? How did you kind of stumble across that?
So I've done a lot of mushroom journeys. That's probably the medicine I'm most connected to in the triple digits, and I've facilitated a lot of guided ceremonies as well. So that would start quite innocent at, you know, 17, 18 years old in England. You go into the pastures, into the fields, and pick all the liberty caps that are growing on the dung out in the fields. And me and my friends would just go to the woods in the evening, have a fire, and we just eat all these mushrooms that we'd found. And so it wasn't for spiritual purposes. You know, it was just teenage boys having fun, so to speak. But I think regardless of the intention, the work is done, whether you know it or not. So it's almost like it's like a rebalancing or a resetting of the mind. So I think it made me much more open in terms of like cognitive dissonance or belief systems. I think it opens that wide open. So it just makes you, I think it makes you much more open to information and things beyond this realm or reality that as we know it. Went to the States. I worked in the medical cannabis industry in California for 2 or 3 years and knew a guy there that was very, very good at growing mushrooms. So I had a few experiences over there that were quite profound. That really sent me down kind of a rabbit hole into guys like Terence McKenna, Ram Dass, who's my guru, I would say. I've learned a lot from Ram Dass and his lectures. Timothy Leary, guys like that. So just kind of the LSD world of Harvard University in the 60s and 70s. Like I said, Ram Dass definitely a huge, I guess, guru in my life that kind of led me down that path. Just seeing his background as Richard Alpert, this Harvard University professor, and went to India, studied yoga and came back, Ram Dass. And his biggest breakthroughs in terms of spirituality came from mushrooms. So it really pushed me to dive deeper into that. Probably about 26 years old when I did my first hero's dose, as Terence McKenna named it. So I think your psychedelic experience is about 3.5 grams of psilocybin cubensis, which is a common species that grows in the States. And that's the one that Ram Dass and Terence McKenna were using. So I did a hero's dose with gold tops or subs, native New Zealand species, which are very, very potent. So unbeknowingly did 5 grams of subs, which is, I think, the equivalent of about 9 grams of cubensis, and had a complete ego death experience. It was the most profound experience I've ever had in my life.
Tell us more. I want to know what happened for you at that point.
Profound good or profound really fucking scary?
I have my notes here. So I have a trip report book. So any medicine in the name of science, I document it as detailed as I can. You won't be able to really see it on camera. It's just funny because as I was coming out of that journey, I was taking notes, but my hand couldn't move fast enough for what was going on in my head. So it just looks like a load of scribble. But then I did a detailed report the next day after I'd kind of integrated the experience a little bit. And so that's a little bit more detailed. But the first one was quite interesting, the scribble on the day of the ceremony. So the messages that came through, I'll just read some of it, was focus on freeing minds, keep doing meditation, breath work. It must happen now. I'd written a line on this side was infinite awareness, consciousness, love, empathy, and compassion. On the other side was disconnection from spirit, egoic, materialistic, possessive, anger, only viewing through the five senses, not realizing one's true power and conformity. So it was this like slide down either side. Increased love and awareness. I was doing strong breath work, like deep diaphragmatic breath work, but it was involuntary. My body felt way more open and free. Must express and give love more. I had a relationship that ended quite badly around that same time at 19 years old. And I definitely closed my heart off after that. And this just kind of blew it wide open. I spent probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours crying like a baby into the pillow, just like snot, tears, just a mess. I was just purging and shedding a lot of stuff that I've carried, I guess, throughout my life. I felt Ramdas's consciousness burst inside me, which is the most profound experience I've ever had. And this was about 7 or 8 months after he passed away. Very sweaty, distorted time, involuntary body movements. I had a really bad shoulder at that point, and my arm was doing involuntary movements like this. After research, I think they call it God's arm. There's a name for it. So I was doing all these weird movements. And then for about 3 weeks, all the neural tension and pain in my shoulder was gone. It's like my body was kind of readjusting or releasing neural tension in my neck and my arm. Show love more, give love more, show appreciation, not through material, but through love. Love is power. Breathing is the foundation, so important, and it must come before everything else. Huge emotional release, like I explained, a massive release of physical and mental tension. Huge overwhelming wave of compassion. An internal battle at the start, which was the battle of the ego. It was like I had this kind of, you come back into the mind and it was like, I've eaten the wrong mushrooms. I've eaten poisonous ones. I'm dying. I'm going to die. And it was just half an hour plus, who knows how long it was, of me just battling that feeling.
The surrender.
Yeah, as soon as I surrendered to that, that's when all these profound realizations start to come through. It's quite interesting, whether it's psilocybin, whether it's ayahuasca, DMT, it always comes back to the same thing, which is love. Give love, show love, express love, be love. That is everything. So with all of these different journeys, all of these different medicines, it always comes to the same conclusion, which is just love.
Where were you while all this was going down? Were you somewhere like relatively appropriate, or were you like
raised? I was in my bedroom.
Okay, cool.
I planned it for a little while. Like I said, I'd done a lot of journeys previous, but this was the first time I was diving into the hero's dose. So I kind of planned it out. I had my housemate around. He just sat in the living room just in case I needed him or anyone knocked at the door or anything like that. So I was just in my room for about 8 hours, curtains closed, blindfolded, no music, just silence and darkness, no external stimulation.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was pretty profound.
So after that, I mean, I'm guessing there would have been a bit of an integration period after a situation like that, because there tends to be when your body is catching up with your consciousness and you're shedding all of these kind of shadows and shells and all of the things. What did your life look like going forward?
Yeah. How did my life look going forward? I became a lot, again, this is a continuous path. So as I said, when I was a kid and I was a teenager, I was probably very volatile. I was quite angry. I had a lot of stuff in my childhood that would have caused that. Yeah, just no regulation or control of emotion, no awareness of emotion. So one of my favorite quotes is your emotions, thoughts, and actions should be a servant to your mind. Your mind should not be a servant to your emotions, thoughts, and actions. So when I was a kid, teenager, I was a servant to my emotions, thoughts, and actions. I would fall into anger without even realizing or being aware of it. And the more I've gone into self-growth, the more separation there is from Brad and the Atman or the true self. So I'm in a place of witness. So I would say as I've gone through these journeys, that spaciousness becomes greater in the sense that I can observe and watch myself. And that definitely ramped up after that hero's dose. I was just a lot more gentle, a lot calmer. I didn't fall into reactivity as easily. And if I did, I could see it arising. The profound one was my heart being blown wide open, because it had been, you know, I was in a relationship from when I was about 14 till 19. So it was quite a long relationship for that age. And you know, a very sensitive time of your life. So I was really depressed after that breakup. It really affected me, which is all perfect. It's, there is no coincidence. It's all grand design. So had I not gone through that kind of suffering and trauma of that situation, I wouldn't have gone to America and I wouldn't have ended up on this path, most likely. So all by grand design. But there was probably a good 4 or 5 years where, as Ram Dass would call it, I was the horny celibate monk. I was avoiding relationships or intimacy of any kind, just because I didn't want to feel that hurt again. So it's just kind of like I shut this off. And if you imagine your heart with a load of chains and bolts wrapped around it, this hero's dose just kind of like blew them off. And it was just like, oh, feeling again, which is why I just had that hour or two of just crying and feeling overwhelming love. And it's just like I've been blown wide open. So my ability to show and express love changed a lot after that. I did a lot of healing with my mother. Like, I called her and I told her I loved her and did a lot of healing there. So it made me much more open and less fearful of showing love and receiving love. So I think that was a huge catalyst for my growth that came afterwards.
Those heart-opening experiences are super intense, right?
Super intense, yeah.
I had one when I was completely sober, just driving down the road once, and it was like I was, yeah, just driving around the roundabout, and all of a sudden my heart just exploded open and I was in tears, and it was super intense.
I find those fascinating, those situations.
Yeah.
You know, there's no medicine involved, there's no deep breath work involved, it's just a shift.
Yeah.
I find those stories fascinating.
But they're very profound, because they definitely change the way in which you then go forward and approach life.
Yeah, it's like I was almost shutting myself off or starving myself from experiencing human emotions, just because of the hurt that can come with it. And yeah, as Ram Dass would say, you can keep your heart open in the hellfire, accept the suffering, accept loss and sadness and all of these things, but keep your heart open. That's true power, to be able to stay in that space. And that hero's dose definitely changed things for me on a very deep level.
So, sorry, what is a hero's dose? Like, how many grams are you talking to, like, push to that?
A hero's dose is 5 grams plus. When Terence McKenna came up with the analogy of the hero's dose, he was talking about cubensis. And so, obviously, there's so many different strains and species of mushrooms, some more potent than others. So you'd have to kind of work out the potency to get the right amount, which is, like I said, I did not do. I took a much more potent strain and took 5 grams of it, which would be probably about 8 or 9 grams of cubensis, the equivalent. And that's just something he came up with. He said, you know, do it in a dark room, do it blindfolded, no music, no external stimulation. So you're going inwards for that full journey. Which, as you can imagine, can be confronting or very uncomfortable. And I think that's the beautiful part about it. I think even, not that it was a bad trip, like I said, the start was probably the most intense part of this battle, this ego battle, and I had to surrender and let go. And once you can surrender, it's the same with any other plant medicine, DMT especially. Once you can surrender, you're just met with infinite love and the most profound realizations you could possibly ever have. So
it's really cool listening to you say all of this, because I feel like when I meditate a lot and I do a lot of heavy breath work without, you know, doing any plant medicine at all, it's the same messages come through. So it's kind of nice. I mean, obviously I know that that is a legit channel that's coming down, but there is that ego side sometimes where you're like, is this actually a thing, or am I just, this is just a little voice inside my head? And then when you hear what you're talking about, it's like, yeah, I'm good out here. My meditation is like fully aligned, like these things coming through, it's legit. And yeah, it must be amazing to be able to amplify that with the use of plant medicines.
Yeah,
so how do you how do you prepare for that? So, you know, I think there's a difference between doing it recreationally, where you're just kind of other than having no stimulation around you, but leading up to that, what is the best way to align your body and kind of get yourself into a like a space where you're open to receive it and you're not kind of flooded with other toxins? Or like, how long would you kind of build yourself up to get into a space to like kind of appreciate it more?
I think there's a huge correlation with breath work and plant medicine. So even with the ayahuasca sits I've done, breath work is a huge aspect leading up to it. You can really gauge someone's level of where they're at through breath work, because we'll do, you know, hour and a half breath work journeys. And can they stay, we'll put blindfolds on them while they're doing the breath work so they can't open their eyes and have external stimulation. Again, it's going inwards, it's going into the self. And I think, as you said yourself, the ego mind will kind of come back in. So we keep this constant no pause between the inhale and the exhale, which doesn't give you time to come back to the mind. So we're trying to bypass the mind and come into the heart space, which is where you sit when you're on the medicine. And so I think going into deep breath work is the closest possible thing you could experience to psychotropic medicines. So doing breath work and having experience with breath work before these kind of experiences, I think is a huge benefit. A bad trip is just someone being stuck in the mind, or the ego is fighting or trying to control what's going on. And the more you try to control and navigate, the harder it becomes. You have to surrender to it. And so the practice of surrender is hugely beneficial, whether that's through breath work or experience with vipassanas or, you know, deep meditations, fasting. All these different things can be of great benefit moving into ceremony. If I'm guiding a psilocybin ceremony, I think the prep work for a mushroom experience isn't usually as intense as it is with other medicines. So say if you're sat with ayahuasca, you want a good month plus, if you're really going hard, where there's no alcohol, there's no caffeine, there's no drugs, no meat, your diet is very, very light. This is not only just to prime and prep and clear the body, but also to make you aware of your attachments. So if you are leading up to a ceremony and you're someone that might use cannabis on a regular basis and you're struggling to not use it, this is bringing it into your awareness that there might be an addictive pattern there or a habit. And then that might come up in ceremony, and you're going to be able to deal with that. Yeah, get something out of it where you're going to be able to deal with that that addiction or that repetitive habit. So a big part of the dietary prep is just making you aware of your lifestyle, I suppose. But if I'm taking a guided ceremony, I would tend to have people not eat on that day or have a very light breakfast. Distilled water, I'm a big fan of. I think it's great for just clearing out the system and all these metals and toxins and fluoride that we have build up from the water that we drink. What I say, are you practicing mindfulness or mindlessness? So in those weeks leading up to a ceremony, you want to be listening to educational podcasts, whether it's on plant medicine or consciousness. The more awareness you can build around what you're doing, I think the more you get out of the experience. Are you watching Gaia or are you watching Netflix? What content are you feeding your mind? Like, not only what are we feeding the body, but what are you feeding your mind leading up to that experience? You don't want to be watching the news for the week leading up to it and all that, and having that heaviness and the fear that's driven into us. So you want to be very light on what you're consuming, not only food-wise, but material-wise as well.
What kind of profound changes or experiences have you seen in your clients, if you call them that, when you host these ceremonies? And what do people walk out of that with? It must be quite a humbling experience for you, I can imagine.
Oh, it's the most satisfying experience, I think, of all the work that I do. That's the most special to me, because I've experienced it myself, and I know just how profound that can be in terms of how it can transform and change your life. Every ceremony is different. I tend to do one-on-ones or very, very small groups with mushrooms. If you were to sit with, say, ayahuasca, you're talking anywhere up to 30, 40, 50 people in a group. It's a very large ceremony, and there's a lot of power in having that many people. But with psilocybin, I find one-on-one is probably the most effective because everybody's journey is different and everyone's in a different place. I will use a lot of music, a lot of tracks, masculine tracks, feminine tracks, and I'm kind of monitoring and watching that person's experience. Certain songs will resonate. For example, I had an Indian girl that sat with me. She had kind of a childhood background in Hinduism, and Hinduism is a very strong pull to me when I'm in ceremony. There's a lot of Hindu, like Hanuman, Ganesh. These are deities that I will do mantra to before ceremony. And that's Ramdas's and Maharaj's lineage as well. So that's kind of why I've got this strong pull to Hinduism. But she was in the experience. I was going through different tracks, and I played a track that was a Hindu mantra track. And she just burst into tears. She was looking up, her hands were like this, and she was having a complete spiritual experience. And so I navigated the music in that direction. For the remainder of the ceremony, I kept it in this kind of Hindu energy. And she had the most profound connection. It was like this connection to God, to Brahman, to the universal source. Some people will find it hard. Some people have hard experiences. I'm just there to hold space. So I'm just a mirror for their energy. If they're happy going inwards, I'm holding space. I'm saging Palo Santo. I'm making herbal tea, candles. I'm just holding that space as nurturing and as safely as possible. But some people want to talk. So they want to talk it through. That's how they're learning, through trying to understand it through conversation. And so if they want to talk, I will sit there and then we'll have conversation at the same time. But in terms of what people get out of it, again, it's that same thing. It's the opening of the heart. It's becoming a much gentler, softer person, less reactive in terms of falling into anger and stress. Its effects on depression and anxiety are profound. Not that I've worked with anyone really with PTSD. I've worked with people with a lot of childhood trauma that have gone very deep into that in a ceremony in a very intense way and managed to release it.
But how do you find that when you are experiencing someone that's bringing all these things up and they're not necessarily in the most coherent state? How do you navigate that experience?
I tend to be in the force as well. So even when I'm holding a ceremony, I'll have a magic number, a certain doses that I'll take. That allows me to feel when the medicine's coming on. When it's coming on for me, I know it's coming on for them. I can feel the potency of the experience, because obviously depending on the species of mushroom you use, or even one mushroom to another, there can be a different level of psilocin in it. So I can feel kind of the level they're at and when it's wearing off. So that's how I navigate, knowing where they're in the space, but it also makes me much more sensitive to energy. It's like I can see the person, where I can see all of these layers of emotion underneath it. And that just teaches me how to react and navigate that situation. If I need to do any energy healing in that space, which is often the case. But it's the same thing in breath works as well. I think the more you do that work, you become much more sensitive and aware to energies in the room. And so we can be taking someone through a deep breath work. They could be bursting into tears. They could be shaking. They can have this complete out of body type experience. And it's knowing when to touch, when not to touch. If there's an area of pain, I usually get to put the hand up and I will press into it and do energy work on the area. And that will usually cause a huge emotional release. But I've kind of seen it all over the last 10 years. People, whether it's breathwork or medicine, just people screaming and shouting, bursting into fits of laughter. There's probably nothing I've not seen. So I can stay very grounded and calm no matter what that person is going through. And I think that's the biggest part of holding space, is you being able to keep your energy centered, because it's essentially a practice for me as well. You know, can I stay completely present in a ceremony, or am I in the eye game? You know, am I thinking about, oh, I want to go do this later. I'm going to go do, like, the wants and needs of the eye have to completely fall away. And so I'm just a vessel, or as the Native Americans would call it, a hollow bone. So I think once you've cleared a lot of your own shit, a lot of your own trauma, you become a hollow bone for spirit. And I think that's the biggest part of a ceremonial space, is just being able to stay completely present for that person and staying in grounded energy.
Such a key piece, even physiologically, for being able to actually process and heal trauma is being in the space of somebody who has a regulated nervous system. Because if you're doing that sort of work with someone who doesn't, you can re-traumatize yourself quite easily.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the same across the board. It's like a good friend of mine is a dog psychologist. He works with dog energy. A bad dog, or a dog that's anxious, or a dog that's aggressive, is just a reflection of its owner's energy. And the dog is just picking up on its owner's vibration, on its owner's energy at that time. And so how we hold our own space and our own energies has a massive effect on not just other humans, but animals, plants, you name it.
Mm. Are you able to dip a little bit into the science of working with psilocybin, how it kind of affects us in this way and opens us up in this kind of profound way?
Yeah, I mean, the shaman I've sat quite a lot with had a really good analogy. And he said it's almost like if you imagine the mind or the brain as a mountain, and you've got your little sled and you slide down this mountain and you create grooves in the snow as you go down this mountain, you come back to the top and you go down, you go back to the top and you go down, and you've created all these grooves. And so what starts to happen is you come to the top of the mountain, you slide down, and you start to fall into these paths or these grooves that have already been carved out. And so you imagine that we're creating these grooves or these paths throughout our whole life, especially in those first several years of existence, where we're just a sponge from our parents, from teachers. This is when we're really learning and starting to understand how to interact socially. And this is also one of the most vulnerable, because we can pick up a lot of trauma. And so these grooves start to get cut and we start to fall into these grooves. This is like the synapses of the brain, and we can have negative synapses that start to stick. And so we can easily fall into negativeness, into anger, into frustration. These are pre-cut grooves in the brain. And it's almost like when you do a journey, whether with whichever plant medicine it is, it's almost like a fresh blanket of snow on top of the mountain. And you come back to the top and now you go down, but you can create new pathways and new grooves, because those old grooves that have been very deeply dug have now been covered with a fresh blanket of snow. And I kind of like that analogy of it. It's almost like a resetting of the mind, or a rebalancing of the mind. 98% of the day, I think it is, if you listen to any Bruce Lipton stuff, or you're going to Joe Dispenza or quantum physics, it's like 98% of the day we're in subconscious mind. This is just repetitive patterning. Creativity is in conscious mind. And so there's not that much of the day we're actually conscious, or most people. The subconscious is just like the bottom of the iceberg, what's under the water that we can't see. And it's a lot of this stuff that's in our subconscious that manifests into our personality of who we are. And so we can't correct or undo things within our personality unless we can dive into the subconscious and start to pull and draw these things out. Another good analogy is almost like if you're in a psilocybin experience, rather than being in your thoughts, in your emotions, it's almost like you're a baby in a cradle, and you're looking at, I don't know what those things are called, above a cot, a little thing with the toys on that kind of...
like a mosaic thing.
Mobile.
Mobile.
Yeah, mobile. It's almost like you're washing a mobile, and this is like trauma here, trauma there, and you can see it from an outside separated perspective. So rather than being in the feeling of it all, you're just kind of witnessing it. And then we can kind of like pick things out and work on them and dissolve them.
Do you have people who sort of come back to you? So they come for like the first sort of ceremony with you, and then they kind of start the unravel of their traumas and all of the things. And then do they go away, kind of get back into life, and then have to come back again because it's kind of their ego state comes back? Or is it kind of like you can have one really like profound experience and that kind of catapults you forward in that way?
Yeah, both. I think that's the power of psychedelic medicines, because the more potent or the more profound it is, the less need there is to do it again. So where with other drugs and chemicals, I think that's where psychedelics can get a bit of a misconception that, you know, you're just a burnout and you just keep doing these substances. But in actual fact, the lessons are so profound and so real that people can do it and think, well, I don't need to do that again. Or they might do it a year later or 2 years later. They feel ready to go back into that experience because you start to forget and those realizations start to fall away. So both, I've had plenty of people sit that get a lot out of one sit and they feel good and they don't need to really sit again, or if they do, it's way down the line. But I can just kind of gauge where someone's at on their own spiritual path, you know, taking someone who might have a lot of trauma and a lot of stuff to work through and throwing them into a hero's dose probably isn't the best thing. And so taking them from a very, very light journey where it's quite fun and playful. So I would say, especially with mushrooms, to me, because I can feel the different essences or energies of a certain medicine. So ayahuasca's Pachamama, the madre, it's the mother medicine. It's a feminine energy. You can feel it. It's a hard thing to explain. San Pedro, peyote, the Native Americans have used these cactuses, is mescaline. They call it the grandfather medicine. It's got a very old man, kind of grandfather, warm hug type feeling to it. Mushrooms are kind of beyond this realm. I feel like they've come from somewhere beyond Earth. They're a very ancient wisdom. As far as I know, mushrooms have been on this planet for millions, if not billions of years. And so it's like they've got this long knowledge within them. They've seen everything. And so when you're on the lighter dosages, you're more in control. So you're starting to tap into that space and feel these altered states of consciousness, but in a way that you can still navigate, you can still talk, you can still move around. Your ego still has control, I would say. The deeper you go in dosage, the less control you have and the more in control the mushrooms are. And so the higher the dosage goes, the more this starts to happen. And so this is where the surrendering of the ego comes into play. Around 3.5 grams plus is where you're along for the ride. And you've just got to accept, stay with your breath, stay present, and just allow them to teach you whatever's coming through. And so, yeah, you can gauge that depending on the person. It's usually a number that comes through. So I might be having a conversation with someone leading up to it. I'll do a lot of pre-screening, just if they've had any experiences before, if they're on antidepressants, anything, all this stuff we speak into beforehand. And then it gives me I just get a download of what dosage is right for that person. And if it's on the lower end, it's on the lower end. And then maybe they come back after they've done the integration work. I'll make sure they're doing the right thing. So putting them onto breath work, Wim Hof practice, cold showers, listening to educational podcasts, again, filling your mind with mindfulness, not mindlessness. And the more dedicated they are to their own self-growth, that's when we start then going into higher dosages. So that's kind of how I navigate.
What are your thoughts on microdosing then? How does that kind of fit in? Do you think that's like a thing, or is that kind of just you trying to escape normal day life in a way?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other side of it, is we want to be in a space where we can kind of self-regulate and we can be in this space without any medicines, because the goal of the medicine really is just to, and that's another way of Sean would describe it to me, it's like if you think these higher states of consciousness are like the tip of a mountain, it's almost like when you're on the medicine, you get in a helicopter and you're flown to the top of the mountain and you can see the top. You can see how to get there, but that helicopter has to come back down and drop you off. You don't stay up here. But the fact that you've been up there and seen the top and the peak of the mountain, it makes it easier to navigate your way there. So that's how I would describe that. So these medicines can show us these high states, these altered states of consciousness. But the big work is in the integration and how we can reach those levels without any medicine. So that's really the point we want to get to. But in terms of people that are dealing with anxiety, depression, PTSD, things like that, microdosing can be extremely effective. I've experienced and played around with microdosing LSD and psilocybin. And I think there's a definite use for microdosing for sure. I know a lot of people that got a lot out of it. But again, it's not becoming reliant on a substance. It's about using that substance to regulate and create a balance or homeostasis. And then it's, can I keep this level of consciousness just through doing different practices? And that's kind of where I've come to as well. Like I said, I've done a lot of plant medicine, but I'm at the point now where I know I don't need it. Like, I've got my tools, I've got my beads, I can do mantra, I can do breath work, I can do yoga, I can do meditation, I can go do breath work on the beach and go for a swim. There's all these different outlets to stay within your higher self or to be the strongest version of yourself. And so I think that's a great question, because we don't want to become reliant on medicines to feel those states of consciousness, because we can get there without it. It's just a good tool to showing us how to get there.
Just interesting, I think, you know, LSD, because that's not a plant medicine itself, but I guess it sits in the same kind of realm. So what is, to you, like, you would obviously prefer to have like the plant medicine side, but then how does the LSD side, that's like a man-made substance, fit into that? Like, what is your kind of perspective on that side of things?
Well, on a molecular level, LSD is quite similar to psilocybin. I can't think off the top of my head what that looks like. I think there's one nitrogen molecule missing or something like that. And they're very similar on a molecular level, as is DMT and ayahuasca. They're all quite similar in the response they have on the body. But I probably had a good dozen experiences with LSD. Again, profound experiences. It's definitely a different energy to plant medicines. But then again, each plant medicine can be very different to another plant medicine. So I think it has its use. I'm not against using LSD because it's obviously a man-made chemical. Albert Hofmann created LSD, so it can be just as profound. You know, Ram Dass, Timothy Leary, those guys that were Harvard University professors back in the late 60s, that's the chemical they first started studying. So they ordered a full book of LSD from the Netherlands, and they were actually using LSD at Harvard University to just explore how this has an effect on human consciousness. Yeah, I think there's a place for LSD. Would I say plant medicines are a better avenue to go down? Yes. I think there's a lot to plant medicines. It's quite complex. It's not just that one molecule, but it's how all of the other constituents in that plant work in cohesion with the other to kind of create that full experience. But yeah, it has its use. I've had some of the most amazing experiences in my life have been with LSD. So
you mentioned earlier, you know, that you hold these kind of shamanic ceremonies, which obviously holding someone in a mushroom ceremony is. Were you kind of initiated? Do you call yourself a shaman? Is this like, is probably quite a big topic to go into, but do you consider yourself a shaman? And is that something that you were like initiated into, or was like, is it a self-initiation? How was that process?
Yeah, I would say I'm too humble to call myself a shaman. People do call me a shaman. I don't like calling myself a shaman, especially the more and more I've gone into it. I've done past life regressions. I was a Native American shaman. In a past life, I've got a very strong connection to Native American culture and have since I was like 6-7 years old, but never knew why. And the more, again, it's not about learning, it's about remembering. So the more I peel back and the more I go into the self, the more I remember or realize, I suppose. So it was really profound. I sat with this shamanic healer 2 years ago, and she told me that I was a Native American shaman in a previous life, and that I was a Nordic shaman in a previous life, Scandinavian. And I've got deep ties to Nordic culture, to the Viking culture. My mum's side has got a lot of Scandinavian in it, and then the strong pull to Native American culture. So she was telling me these things, and I cried. It was really emotional because I've had strong pulls to these two cultures, but never really knew why. She told me to go deeper into light language. And so using my voice, he says your ceremonies will be even more powerful if you start using your voice. So I got into going into light language and singing in ceremony. So I'll sing medicine songs in ceremony, drums, rattles, different instruments. I've got my grandfather flute coming in a couple of weeks, so I'll be using that in ceremony as well. Why I don't call myself a shaman? I sat with a Native American shaman probably like a month before lockdown. And the deeper you go into, like, I don't know if you've heard of Don Juan. He went and studied out in South America and underneath Mexican shamans. There's a book, I've got it here, called Grandfather by Tom Brown. So he wrote a book called Grandfather. He's got a series of books I'd highly recommend. And that book kind of just documents the life of his grandfather, who was one of the, I suppose, the last true Native Americans that still lived off the land and was very, very connected to spirit. These things are falling away. With each generation, we lose a lot of knowledge with shamanic practices. But my Native American teacher said everything is imagination until proven otherwise. So she could actually go into spirit realms. And by the way, Native American shamans, believe it or not, even though peyote and San Pedro have become plant medicines they use in the last 200 years, a lot of these shamans won't even go near psychotropics. Like, they won't even drink green tea or caffeine. Like, they keep their bodies so pure in order to connect very strongly to these other realms. And so they won't even use plant medicines. And so she was able to go into spirit realms, say, receive a feather or pick up a feather, come back, open her eyes, and there's a feather in her hand. So she's actually manifested or materialized something from the spiritual world into this physical realm, which most people can't even get their head around. That's just mind-blowing. To be able to actually bring a physical object back from other realms and manifest it and bring it into this one. She wouldn't even call herself a shaman, because the shamans that she sat with and the ones that came before them, especially if you get into like Don Juan's work, were able to shapeshift or take on the form of an animal. So it's like, as the generations go on, especially with the kind of the Western world's influence globally, it's like these practices are falling away. And so while I know my skill set and the power of what I can do, I still wouldn't call myself a shaman based off what shamans in days gone by could actually do, because they had a lot of power. And you're talking 30, 40, 50 years of daily dedication, and a lot of people these days aren't even in the space to be able to do that, you know, to not use any plant medicines, to sit in nature, to do sweat lodges, to do vision quests like the Native Americans do. I mean, you're dedicating your life to developing the ability to enter those realms. And in the world we live in now, most people wouldn't have the time, the dedication to get into that.
No, we're householders, you know, we're here to kind of be among people, kind of living somewhat everyday lives in a way. And that's kind of why I asked, was there initiation? Because, yeah, to me, I feel as though the word shaman is quite sacred. And to get to that point seems like there is a full-on process that happens with that, you know?
Yeah, most definitely. And there's different ways of navigating that or getting to that space. Like I said, plant medicines, even though I don't like this term, people say it can be a shortcut to enlightenment. It's like you're doing a hell of a lot of work quite quickly, and you can develop the ability to enter these realms, enter these altered states of consciousness through plant medicines. But shamans in days gone by would dedicate their full lives to get into that space. Like, Native American cultures are just a good example of how that works. But they're watching children from a young age. Like, you can watch how children interact, and you can see, okay, this child is going to be a really good hunter gatherer. This child has got connection to spirit. They're seeing energies. They're seeing things. You know, and this is where you really watch children, because they've not developed the ego yet. They've not got to the point of forgetting. There's still an essence of remembrance there. And so you can pick spiritual kids up quite quickly. They'll say certain things. There'll be synchronicities. They'll say they've seen something that's not there. And so it's just watching children in those years of play, and you start to incorporate tools that are going to develop their spiritual practice. So the Native Americans have a medicine wheel, and they'll give the kids the medicine wheel, and they'll play with spirit. They're doing spiritual play. And then this play will start to develop into a spiritual power, and they become very connected. And that's when they can do this really deep healing work. So I think we've lost that as well. unfortunately. It's like in this Western world, all kids, it's like that kind of like Pink Floyd Brick in the Wall video. If you've seen the video to Brick in the Wall, it's like you put these kids on a conveyor belt. They're all bright, happy and shiny, and they go through and they're all wearing the same mask in black and gray, because that's the way our system works. It's just creating obedient workers. And every kid's unique, and you can pick that up quite quickly on what area you can navigate them into. So Native American shamans are practicing the whole life because it picked up at a very young age.
Quite exciting, I think, though, nowadays, because, you know, like Nadia and I have been talking about the power of mushrooms because we've had a couple of great experiences, and we have literally we felt like we manifested you coming onto this podcast today, because we were all about trying to find you, basically, and here you are. And I think it's really exciting because it was almost something that we thought, is this even possible? Do you exist, especially in New Zealand? And it's quite exciting that it didn't actually really take long for you to fall into our laps in a funny way. And for me, it just feels quite exciting because Nadia and I mean, we're not so far into this plant medicine journey, but we're definitely really excited about it. And, you know, I think we're living in an age now where these conversations aren't so taboo or that weird. I think the more you start kind of asking around and having these little quiet conversations, so many people come out of the woodwork now. And it's quite exciting, I think, for our generation, for when we procreate, or if we procreate, we have children ourselves, being these like spiritual beings, actually watching our children grow and nurturing that from a young age and operating in that way. That's kind of how you really shift society and pull this separation from the matrix into this 5D situation, where it actually makes me really excited for the future. Because I went through a good number of years in not wanting children, because I was like, why do I want to bring children into this fucked up world? Like, this is not a vibe. I don't want to like subject my kids to that. And now it's like I've had this kind of restructure in my brain where I've gone, no, I really want to bring children into this world because I want to nurture the magic from day dot and like push that side of things, so that when they're our age, it's the part of the way that they live.
Yeah, you raise a few really good points there. So one is being your authentic self and sitting in your authentic self, because you doing that allows others to be authentic and to find their true selves. And so regardless of whether some of these topics are taboo or not, all I can do is be my authentic self, be my higher self, and speak my truth. Keep my throat chakra open, and like I said, speak the truth, because the more you can stand your ground in that and speak honestly and openly, the more these conversations happen. So we have to treat it as normal, because it is. It's just very backwards that some of these topics can still be taboo, and these things considered alternate medicine when they've been a medicine for thousands of years. You go deep into a lot of religions, even Christianity, Hinduism, a lot of them are founded on psychedelics. There's evidence of psychedelic use at the bottom end of these religions, and that's kind of where a lot of this comes from. The westernized medical system is what, 100 years old, let's say. That is the true alternative medicine. These are medicines that have been used for a very, very long time, and so it's important that we bring it back into normality, because there's a lot of potential there for these medicines, not just in terms of lifting our consciousness and becoming more and more aware outside of this matrix that we're in, but also for healing trauma, because that's where it leads us into the other point that you made. The more work we do on ourselves, the more we can clear our own traumas that are generational cycling, the better life we're going to give to our children, because we're not giving them our trauma patterns. We've evolved consciously, and then that changes our children as well. But regardless, it's interesting to watch, because children, the next generations are more conscious. You know, I think I found consciousness quite young, at 19, 20 years old. Ramdas, my guru, didn't find it till he was in his mid-30s. And now you've got kids. You know, it's like we did a breath work several months ago, and there was someone that brought their three kids. I think it was like a 7-year-old daughter, 5-year-old daughter, and a 3-year-old son. And they were running around the room, just like having fun, going a bit crazy. And the oldest daughter at 7 said to the other two, we need to, our energy is too high. We need to meditate. And the three of them sat there in a circle and started breathing. And I was like, whoa, you know? And I had a friend whose kid, the other week turned around to him and said, Daddy, stop thinking so much. You won't be able to feel your heart.
That's profound.
Isn't it? Yeah. Like she should be working in businesses and corporates teaching these adults, you know, that are grinding 7 days a week and don't know themselves. It's just kids are becoming more conscious. The world is becoming more conscious. This is the battle that we're in right now. It's this yin and yang pull and push of dark energy and this that's trying to keep everything locked down, and then was expanding and opening and realizing that old models don't serve us anymore. So it's just a fascinating time to A, be doing this work, but B, to be alive. Like, our souls picked this time for a reason. And it's to do this work. So
yeah, I kind of had that download come through last night in my meditation just really strongly that it's quite exciting. I was just almost doing a reflection of my journey. I've got quite a lot of similarities to you. I kind of shut my heart down after a breakup, my first love, and really went into like not a good place for a long time. But it's all part of that my story, I suppose, to get me to this point. And it's quite like exciting, I think, to be where I am now in this time, where it's, and same with NADS, it's like we're definitely here for a reason, and we're here to help this energy. And it's really exciting to have felt so weird and like I'm like on this weird little path. Is this even normal? Have I lost the plot? Am I going to get sectioned? Like all this kind of thing. And now it's realizing that all of the tools and all of the wild times and the adventures that I've been on have got me to this point now where it's, we're having these conversations and we're holding our own. And it's really important, especially with what's going on right now. And I think it's actually quite exciting because I can almost see at the very end of this tunnel where it's going to be, and the visuals of that just make it all kind of worthwhile, you know?
Yeah, it's like that great reset or great awakening. And it's like these two different paths that we could go down. But again, that's the silver lining of what's going on, because it's never been so easy to find your tribe. It's like, I can feel it. It's a really weird, it's like there's the 3D reality and the 5D happening simultaneously. And I can feel both is the only way I can describe it. And it's like people are finding the tribes very, very easily, because now more than ever, you can see different viewpoints where people are at. And it's really, really pushing people together. Like I had a meeting the other night with about 30 people that are all wanting to set up a trust and get land together and build like a tiny home community, big gardens in the middle, go back to living closer and more connected to nature. You know, raising kids in that way where they're connected to the earth, they're learning gardening, they're learning all these like skills that we've lost, as opposed to the other reality that they could be living in, which doesn't sound quite as nice. So it's like,
Literally we've been having this conversation. We literally want to do that. So you let us know where you're going to be and we'll have one like right next door and we can all just link up and do our thing. I can't wait. Perfect.
And there's so many people doing it. Like it's actually insane how many people are thinking like this, or at least have been thinking like this for a couple of years, but now more than ever, it's like, it's go time. It's time to actually do this.
With like the lockdowns and all of these restraints that have been put upon us with, you know, we don't have a choice in this situation at this point in time, but it's become very apparent to me that your community now is so important, like who's around you, because if for whatever reason I can't get across the border and go see my family and la la la, it's like my family now become the people in my radius, and it's now becoming very apparent to me where I want to position myself. Like I do not want to be in a city anymore. I want to be in nature around like-minded individuals. So if for whatever reason we're cut off from the world, it's not actually a big deal, and that fear state doesn't arise because we've positioned ourselves in a place and space where it's like, okay, well, that 3D scenario can carry on doing its dark force thing, and then it's not going to really affect us because we've sort of prepared for it in a funny way.
That's the true rebellion. It's not being anti anything. It's not fighting what's there, because you're just putting energy into it. the two things they can't fathom or understand is love and humor. If we can stay in love and humor, stay in love and compassion, formulate community, and it's like that model doesn't serve us anymore. We're just not even going to pay any attention to it. We're just going to do our thing here. And the more people that fall into that space, the more powerful it is and the quicker the change happens. But like I said, it's happening everywhere. Like a friend of mine, Franco Hecky, runs Spirit Fest and Resolution Festival. He's just got 150 acres up in Kaiapoi Harbour. So they're setting up a community there and also a place they can run festivals from. We're doing some work in Waiwera and setting something up there. So it's just all cropping up. It's all happening. And like I said, everyone's in the same space, but it's just connecting and finding your tribe. So if there is anyone out there that's feeling a little lonely and isolated in their viewpoints and you're around the Auckland area, just reach out. We set up something called the Holistic Hub in Mission Bay at the start of the year. And so we took over an old church, and it's just like a holistic wellness center. So we work on the mental, the emotional, the physical, and the spiritual. So breath works, kirtan performances, drumming circles, ecstatic dance, cacao ceremonies, just really building this kind of holistic wellness and getting people on board to do the work.
So exciting.
Yeah.
So exciting.
Yeah, it's great. It's times like this that just like push out creativity. You know, like the best music we've got came through times of strife and suffering. You listen to John Lennon music, so John Lennon's lyrics, or I can't think of any of the examples off the top of my head, but it's in times like this that art and music and expression really come through and come through really strongly. It's just a silver lining. Like I said, it's creating a wave of consciousness, and the ripples just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Amazing. Well, I'm just conscious of time here, and I feel like this is quite a nice place to wrap up this, even though I feel like we could talk to you for forever.
Days.
We can always do another one.
We can. Because I'd love to do almost like a full episode directed towards breath work, you know, because I feel like that is such a potent modality that is just so available to anyone.
We could even do a little guided breath work as well.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for your wisdom and your time. Do you want to give any of your social media details or anything like that so people can find you, or where can they find you?
You can find me Brad Roach on Facebook, or if you want to go on Instagram or my Facebook business page, it's Yogic Brad, YogicBrad, Instagram or Facebook, and then the Holistic Hub, AKL. So you can check out the Holistic Hub on Facebook or on Instagram just to see any events we've got coming up. We've been doing operating an online schedule for the last 3 or 4 months with what's going on, but hopefully our doors open back up soon and we can get back into having physical community again. If you need anyone to talk to, reach out. That's a big part of my work. I go sit at the beach two days a week, and just I've got my little sign. If anyone needs to talk, I'm here for you. So just come and sit and talk. And if you need anything, reach out. We've got a strong community of healers and practitioners, not only in Auckland, but dotted around New Zealand. So if you're interested in any of these modalities, or have any questions, just reach out.
Thank you so much.
Namaste.